Now we will begin with Dr. Wortle.
Good morning. I'd like to start out and give you a little bit of a background on the issue of cancer and transplantation. And also, after we do that, describe for you the survey that was conducted by the National Kidney Foundation that was focused on finding out what patients know and what they'd like to know about these risks. And then also at the end, we'll spend a little bit of time about what actually patients can do about cancer risk following transplantation. The importance of this subject is just as important in transplant patients, and maybe even somewhat more important than it is in the general population. If you look at the causes of death in the general population, number one is cardiovascular disease, and number two is cancer. In transplant patients, it's similar, except historically, infection has been somewhat more common cause of death than has been malignancy. But still, malignancy remains a major cause of death in patients once they have a successful transplant. Data from the Australia and New Zealand registry of tumors in transplant patients has shown us that after 20 years of immunosuppression with a successful transplant, approximately 60% of patients will have experienced some type of cancer. Now, the great majority of these are skin cancers, and most of which can be, if they're detected early, can be treated surgically and pose little risk to the patients. The other important fact to realize is now with the increasing success rates of transplantation, there are increasing numbers of patients who are surviving who are currently on immunosuppression. Estimated in the United States now, there are probably over 100,000 patients who have a functioning solid organ transplant and are on immunosuppression and are at risk for cancer. The first recognition that immunosuppression to prevent rejection could be associated with an increased risk of cancer was 40 years ago in 1967. At this time, Dr. Israel Penn, who was the founder of the Israel Penn Transplant Tumor Registry, was in Denver with Dr. Starzl, and they noted that they had three living donor kidney transplant recipients that had lymphomas. And they were all very young. They were ages 14, 20, and 23. And they all occurred over a very short period of time, over a five-month period. They were very surprised by this clustering of what is in the general population a relatively rare tumor. They then called centers around the world, there being less than a dozen centers around the world, and they found another two patients. And in 1969, they reported this, and it was the first report of an increased risk of an individual cancer following transplantation. Today, the most common cancer that transplant recipients experience is skin cancer. It's just the same as in the general population. But there are a group of cancers that have an increased incidence in transplant patients as compared to the general population. In other words, certain cancers, the most common cancers like breast cancer, lung cancer, prostate cancer, do not appear to be increased significantly in transplant recipients. However, certain tumors, such as lymphoma, Kaposi sarcoma, vulvar, and anal carcinomas occur with markedly increased risks, tenfold to a hundredfold increased risks in transplant patients. What each of these particular types of cancers have in common is that they are virally driven. There are specific viruses that drive these particular cancers. For example, for lymphoma, it's known that the great majority of post-transplant lymphomas are driven by Epstein-Barr virus, the same virus that causes infectious mononucleosis. Kaposi sarcoma is skin cancer, a particular type of a skin cancer. It can occur in the GI tract also, but it is driven by human herpes virus 8. Vulvar and anal cancers may be driven by papillomaviruses. And so these particularly virally driven tumors are felt to be a direct result of immunosuppression allowing the increased proliferation of these viruses. Now, it is important to realize that although there is an increased risk of cancer, the relative amount of the increase in the risk of cancer is not enough to overtake cardiovascular risk. In general, it's a fairly small increase overall in these patients, but nevertheless, we still need to educate our patients so that they're aware of this, so that when they provide their informed consent that they undergo a transplant, that they know about this. And also, more importantly, as we're going to spend a fair amount of time talking about today, that they do the things that they can do to decrease these risks, and also to assure that if they develop a cancer, that it gets detected early. Now, there are a number of scientific registries that actually collect data on this and do studies, largely epidemiologic studies, on patients and on this risk of cancer. Examples of this are the Israel Penn Tumor Registry, also the Scientific Registry of Transplant Recipients in the United States. The Australia and New Zealand Registry is a very very good registry that exists in Australia and New Zealand. And then there's a registry also in Sweden and one in the United Kingdom. Certain of these registries are required reporting. For example, the Swedish, the United Kingdom, are mandatory reporting agencies required by government. The Australia New Zealand Registry is not mandatory, but all programs participate very actively in this, and therefore it's good data. The Israel Penn Tumor Registry is actually a little bit differently. It is a voluntary registry. Programs provide their patients' data to the registry. The reason a lot of programs do that is because the Penn Tumor Registry is the only registry that provides free consults. For example, about 400 free consults are provided around the world each year to programs who have a patient with a cancer or want to transplant a patient with a history of a cancer, and they call the registry to ask for information and also for advice in this. Let's move on and talk a little bit now about the National Kidney Foundation and its survey that was conducted and what they found. This survey was conducted by Clear Consulting, and they were retained by the National Kidney Foundation to conduct this particular survey. So this survey was conducted by email and also by mail. It included 409 transplant recipients in the United States. The reason that the National Kidney Foundation undertook the study was to understand what transplant recipients know or their perceptions of what they know about malignancy, and also to identify the ways that patients prefer to be educated. There were key issues that the questionnaire addressed for transplant professionals. First, it asked, when do patients want to learn about the increased risk of cancer associated with transplantation? It also asked, who do they want to have tell them about these risks? And it also asked, who actually told them about it when they went through the process? It asked them what they wanted to know. In other words, what was the type of information that they wanted to receive? The surveys also looked at the actual steps that the patients currently take. It asked how often patients want to be reminded about these cancer risks and about prevention. And another thing that it did was it actually looked at differences amongst regions in the United States to ask questions, are there particular regions in the United States that do better or do worse than do other regions? And what the I'd like to describe for you now a few of the observations that this study found. First of all, it found that patients feel that they are fairly knowledgeable about many of the aspects of living with a transplant, but they don't feel quite as knowledgeable about cancer warning signs and risk factors and prevention. The surveys also found that patients are not always taking all the possible steps in prevention. While at least three-fourths of the patients had an annual physical and a screening test, only about half of the patients were doing regular breast and testicular exams. And less than a third consistently used sunscreen and protective clothing when they were outside with significant sun exposure. They also found that less than a third of transplant recipients felt they'd learned enough and had heard enough from the response. So most of these patients felt like that there was a need for more education that was out there. These patients also welcomed ongoing cancer education even beyond the time when they had their transplant. And they would like to hear this more than just once or twice a year. They'd actually like to hear about it several times a year. Only 1 out of 10 patients recalled ever being told about the increased risk of cancer. Now, it's very likely that substantially more patients were told about it. But when asked these patients for recall, only 1 out of 10 actually recalled that. Most of these patients, when they were asked who did they want to receive the information from, the most common answer was their transplant physician. However, they did feel that a number of other resources were useful, including transplant centers with educational brochures, transplant coordinators who helped evaluate them and take them through the process, and also other program personnel, including social workers. They felt that their amount of information that they received could be improved, and they actually noted that almost all of them wanted to hear about the cancer risk prior to transplantation. Now, this was particularly important for people that were under 65 years of age, for those that did not have a college degree, and particularly for those who received a kidney rather than non-kidney organs such as a heart, a liver, or a lung. When patients were asked what percentage of them actually heard about transplantation, 50% said that they first heard about it before they actually underwent their transplant evaluation. And a smaller percentage, much smaller percentage, learned about it after the transplant. Now, when they were asked who actually told them about the cancer risk and individual risk factors, and who was the person that was actually informing them, the most common response was a transplant physician or a transplant coordinator. Then following that were people such as the dietitians, the social workers, and they also mentioned, about a third of the patients mentioned that they got data from patient support groups. When patients heard that the cancer risk was associated somewhat with their immunosuppressive drugs, the responses were that most of them actually tried to go and learn more about it. 75% of these patients would actually go and try to learn more about this, and they would talk to their physician, and about two-thirds of them were willing or actually went and actually changed their behavior and went about reducing their risks. When patients were asked about cancer prevention education or things that they can do to actually prevent the cancer, only about a third said that they felt they learned enough. About another third felt that they had learned some information, but they still wanted to hear more. And about a fourth of patients felt that they hardly learned anything about cancer education. Now, when patients were asked about specific cancer risk factors, and they were asked if they knew anything or their degree of knowledge, a great majority, 85% of patients, felt that they had a fairly adequate knowledge about the risks of smoking and also the risk of sun exposure. About half of the patients felt that the role of exercise and their eating habits, that they had enough, and also their weight, that they had enough knowledge about that. Most patients felt like they didn't know enough about the individual drugs or the medications that they were on and what those risks were. What I'd like to do now is discuss a little bit about what patients can do in order to try to prevent their risks or to reduce their risks of cancer. First of all, when you look at the types of cancers that they get, the most common type is skin cancer. Wearing a sunblock when patients are going to go outside and when they're going to actually have a substantial amount of skin exposure is something that's very easy to do, doesn't require a lot of expense. If they're going to use a sunblock, they need to make sure that they use a sunblock that has a very high SPF, or skin protection formula. And these should be in the level of at least about 40%. There are actually skin blocking agents that can come that approach 100% efficiency in blocking the harmful rays that can be harmful to patients, and so that's the easiest thing to do. Actually wearing broad-brimmed hats and long-sleeve shirts and actually protecting exposed areas during prolonged skin exposure is also an additional thing that patients can do. Now, not all clothing protects against exposure, and so patients should be aware of the types that do protect and those that don't. Breast and testicular self-exams are important. There are things that individual patients can do, and if applied regularly, both have been shown to increase the likelihood that a tumor, if detected, can be reduced in terms of the advanced stage that it's at. And so patients need to be instructed as to the proper techniques for performing these exams. There's also specific types of screening tests that can be performed in patients. One of these is breast mammograms. And patients need to be informed of the need to obtain mammograms once they reach the age of 50. Prostate-specific antigen testing, or PSA testing, is another thing that can be performed in males, and they need to discuss this with their physicians. And also colonoscopy is another thing that can be performed in patients at regular intervals once they tend to reach a greater age. I want to spend a few minutes here at the end talking a little bit about some of the new immunosuppressive agents and their roles in prevention of cancer. A few years ago, one of the new agents was developed was a drug that's called rapamycin. It's also called sirolimus. Its trade name is Rapimmune. There's also a derivative that's being developed. It's very similar to this by Novartis. Rapimmune is actually marketed and approved by Wyeth. This drug is very interesting. It is the first immunosuppressive agent that may appear to decrease the risk of cancer. It also may possess anti-cancer activity. Now, this drug acts by working on a metabolic pathway that is called the mTOR signaling pathway, mTOR meaning mammalian target of rapamycin. That's actually the molecule that rapamycin binds to. It turns out that in that mTOR signaling pathway, that there are defects in that pathway that are involved in up to 70% of all human cancers. An easy way to think about this is that mTOR is very involved in cell growth. And what cancer is an uncontrolled or a loss of control of cell growth. In other words, cells just multiply and divide, and they're out of control. And if the mTOR pathway isn't turned off or it's unchecked, it can lead to uncontrolled growth. Now, rapamycin or rapamycin's derivatives can actually shut that pathway down. Now, a number of studies have been done in transplant recipients, and there is some data to suggest that patients that are on rapamycin from the beginning will have a reduced risk of having cancer. Even more importantly, there's a derivative of rapamycin that's called temsirolimus, which has just been shown in a large trial to be very effective against advanced renal cell cancer. So this drug, on a fast track to be approved by the FDA, will probably be approved. And so for the first time, we now have immunosuppressive agents that not only suppress rejection, they also suppress the development of specific tumors following transplantation. So there's a tremendous amount of excitement in the transplant community about this. It is an entirely new paradigm of immunosuppression whereby you have an agent that may not only reduce your risk of losing the graft, but may reduce your risk of getting cancer. And therefore, that sets it apart from all of the other immunosuppressive agents where they increase the risk of developing cancer. And so that is the one thing that transplant doctors and physicians can do. They also there's a number of physicians now that will, if a patient develops a cancer following transplantation, they'll, of course, in addition to reducing the amount of immunosuppression they take, they'll actually put the patient on rapamycin. And for Kaposi sarcoma, there are about 40 cases in the literature now of patients who developed Kaposi sarcoma. They've had their immunosuppression stopped, and they were placed on rapamycin to replace their agents, and they've had a complete disappearance of these cancers. There's also a few anecdotal reports, and so this particular medication is probably going to have a profound impact on this particular issue. So the part about physicians discussing this with patients is another thing that we hope to accomplish by raising people's attention as to this specific topic. With that, I'd like to turn things over and let you hear a little bit of a more social work orientation towards the talk.